Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. France's Fifth Republic since its 1799 revolution was established 60 years ago in 1958 after a period in which it had 21 prime ministers in just 11 years. By contrast, the U.S. has been solid as a rock, one republic, 230 years. But since the election of Donald Trump, many Americans have wondered whether a constitutional crisis is brewing, whether the Senate should be abolished, or whether some heavily Democratic states should even secede. Could the American Republic fail? Well, what would come next? D.D. Guttenplan, an award-winning editor-at-large at The Nation, has looked into the currents of Democratic activism in his new book called The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority, published by Seven Stories Press. I'm very pleased that it brings D.D. Guttenplan to our show now. Hello.
Hi, great to be back, Lenny.
There's been much concern over the growth of populist movements in the United States and Europe, but you take a different take on populism.
I'm pro-populist. I mean, there's a couple of things to say about populism. The first is that, yes, in Europe, populism is a dirty word, and they use it to pretty much only to talk about people like Donald Trump or Viktor Orban or, the leader in Italy.
Or Austria.
They use it at, pardon me?
Austria as well, which has some neo-Nazis in its coalition.
That's right. They use it as a lazy intellectual shorthand for right-wing nationalists. But first of all, I think that's bad history because populism, as I'm sure your listeners will know, is an American invention. And the populist party, the People's Movement, started in the 1890s and was an alliance between farmers who were being crushed by having to mortgage their farms by debt and by what was called the debt lien system in the South, where you would get your seed and your fertilizer in return for a lien on your crops. So you'd take out a debt, and then you'd pay it off at the harvest. But, of course, the terms were so onerous that you seldom paid it off. So it was an alliance between those farmers and between urban workers.
But
and it rose, and it changed the course of American politics. But in the end, it died. It nominated William Jennings Bryan for president. But he was also nominated on the Democratic Party line, and he ended up running only really on a platform of abolishing the gold standard. And then when he lost, part of the frustration of that loss sent American populists down some pretty dark alleys. Tom Watson, who was Bryan's running mate on the People's Party line, the populist ticket, but not on the Democratic line, he became a notorious anti-Semitic newspaper man. He was the person who agitated for the lynching of Leo Frank. So even in America, populism has a mixed legacy. But what I would say is that the kind of populism I am in favor of is a political and cultural movement that represents the majority of the people. And I think if you are a small D Democrat, you can't really favor anything else. I mean, if you're a Leninist and you think that there's some true doctrine that's been disclosed to whatever your leader is, whether it's Bob Avakian or Leon Trotsky or whoever, then you don't need to worry about majorities. But I'm saying that if you're a Democrat and you believe that that the way to bring about political change is to organize a majority coalition or to convince a majority of people or to express the views of a majority of people, then you have no choice but to be a populist.
But hasn't there the populist surge in the United States recently been pretty much on the right? Has there been a surge on the left as well?
Of course there has. Come on. You and I both know there was a populist surge on the left. If you look at it, it's hard to put any other label on the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, who was expressing the desires and the wishes of large numbers of people for things like to live in a country where you had health care guaranteed and where getting sick didn't mean that you might lose your house. People who wanted to live in a country where they could be sure they would be able to send their kids to college without sending them into debt peonage for the rest of their life. So there is a left populism. There's a large left populism recently in the United States. But what I would argue and argue in the book is that part of what happened in 2016, I mean, of course, elections are complex phenomena, but part of what happened in 2016 was that you had a large group of people in the country who were hurting, who were suffering, not just economically. I mean, I think it's a mistake to read this as purely about economics, but certainly if you were a steel worker in western Pennsylvania or in eastern Iowa, or if you had been somebody who made cars, and now the cars that you made were all being made in Mexico. So part of it was economic, but part of it also was this sense of making things, of being people who were productive, you know, who had a productive role in society and in the economy. And if you'd had all that taken away, and then you were told that actually America was already great, which is what Hillary Clinton said, and you knew from your own experience that it certainly wasn't already great, that things were not wonderful, and you were desperate for change, well, the door to change on the left was barred. It was closed. So then people took the only door to change open to them, which was the door on the right, to Donald Trump. I mean, I think those people who did that were deluded and fooling themselves, but I don't think that it was because most of them desperately wanted to be right-wing nationalists. I think it's that they desperately wanted change, and only one candidate was offering drastic, radical change in 2016. Of course, he was lying about a lot of what he was offering, but he was at least pretending to offer radical change.
Well, during this election cycle, the populism of the left is being attacked in a lot of attack ads by Republican candidates saying, if you vote for my opponent, you're going to wind up with socialism in America.
Well, populism and socialism have a long and entwined history. And, you know, in some cases, people are using those as attack ads, and maybe they'll be effective. I don't know. I thought one of the great achievements of the Bernie Sanders campaign was, in addition to, and I write about this in the book, that one of the things that Sanders did was, those of us who are further to the left than liberal have been told for decades that we're marginal, that, you know, that we're just some kind of crazed group. Nobody bothers calling us communists anymore since the fall of the Berlin Wall, but still, the mainstream media constantly emphasizes our marginality. And yet, if you look at the turnout for Sanders, it's clear that there are literally millions of us. So, you know, I think part of what happened was that he did that. He revealed that we are many, but he also detoxified socialism. I mean, if you look at the polls, most young people think socialism is a pretty good idea. So it may work saying that if you vote for X, you'll get socialism. But people are also saying if you vote for X, you'll get Nancy Pelosi. And, of course, Nancy Pelosi is not a populist. She has other virtues and weaknesses, but she's not a populist.
You quote Benjamin Franklin answering a woman who asked, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy? And Franklin answered, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. Are we in danger of losing
it? That's right. Of course we're in danger of losing it. And the reason I quote Franklin saying that in 1789 was because we've always been in danger of losing it. The thing about republics that our founding fathers knew very well, because they were all steeped in the history of Rome and the history of the Venetian Republic, was that republics were thought to be intrinsically fragile. I mean, one of the amazing achievements of America has been to preserve a republican form of government for 200 years plus. But, you know, our republic has always been in doubt. And, of course, its biggest test was the Civil War. And part of what happens, and one of the things I write about in the book, is that we have these periods in our history where, and this is why I call it the next republic, it's not like France, where the government falls and then we have a newly constituted form of government. But it is true that there are these periods in American history when the government is not just elected and, you know, unlike the last time, the person who wins got the most votes, it's not just that. It's not just the sense of a legitimate election. It's that we feel that the government actually belongs to us, responds to us, rather than responding to economic elites or corporate power. And what I write in the book is that there have been at least three periods in our past where this happened, where there was a time when the people felt the government really represented them. And what I'm saying is not that our republic is about to collapse and we're about to become an autocracy, although I would say that there is a danger of that under Trump, and we can talk about that too. But that's not the thesis of the book. The thesis of the book is not that we are going to become like France before de Gaulle. The thesis of the book is that if you look at what people have said they want politically, their demands and their aspirations, there is a majority in favor of genuine radical change. Things like health care, things like ending fracking, things like stopping destroying the earth with fossil fuels. But the political system as it has been exists to keep those things off the agenda in just the same way that in the 1850s, in fact, from 1776 to 1850 or from 1789 to 1850, the political system was structured to keep the issue of slavery off the agenda. In other words, there was profound disagreement over slavery, but what all of the politicians in Washington agreed, except for a few radical abolitionists, was that we weren't going to discuss it. We weren't going to talk about it. It was impossible to do anything about it. In just the same way that if you ask both Republicans and centrist corporate Democrats whether we can have single-payer health care in the United States, they all say, oh, you know, it's impossible. It's not practical. There's consensus that it's impossible. But from time to time, the impossible happens. And the thesis of the book is that if the various movements that have emerged in recent years, and there's a chapter of the book about each of them, if they can coalesce, they amount to a radical majority, and they can bring about this change that we've been told is impossible.
Weren't there progressive?
It's not a panicky book. It's in some ways an optimistic book.
Because we seem to survive all of these the negative surges. There was a progressive and conservative surge. Surges in the 1930s and concerns about whether American democracy might survive at that time, and we survived that. So is there?
Well, we didn't. That's right, but we didn't just survive it. I mean, there's a chapter in my book called "What Happened to the Roosevelt Republic," because there are two things. One is that as I traveled around reporting the presidential campaign for the nation, you know, if you cover a presidential campaign, you spend a lot of time in Ohio. And as I was traveling around Ohio, I would keep coming across these, I came to think of them as relics of a lost civilization. You know, like in the last scene in Planet of the Apes, where you see the Statue of Liberty on the beach and you realize that the lost civilization that they've been talking about through the whole movie is ours. Well, going around Ohio, I would see things like the Bow Federal Building in Canton, this beautiful building with murals on the walls and columns on the outside, or the Rubber Dome in Akron, or the Public Library in Cleveland with these incredible murals of bridging the Ohio River. And at one point I came across a building like this, I think it was in Worcester, Ohio, and the cornerstone said something like Project Number 1132 PWA. And that's when I realized that the lost civilization whose relics I kept coming across was the WPA, was the New Deal and the Works Progress Administration. So part of what happened in the 1930s was a social upsurge, or what if you want to paraphrase, if you want to borrow from Bernie Sanders, you could call a political revolution, when you had things like the Congress of Industrial Organizations, you know, organizing the steel industry and the auto industry, and you had people waging sit-down strikes, and you had, you know, an upsurge of in the fight for racial justice as well. But the other thing that happened, and then you had a federal government that responded to that by reflecting the belief that it was the government's responsibility to make sure that if people couldn't find a job in the private sector, they could find a job. The government made sure that people were employed usefully, and not just usefully in terms of paying them money, usefully in terms of building all of these things that I kept on coming across. You know, I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and in Memphis, the zoo and all the parks were built by the WPA. And if you go downtown, in Memphis, there's a street whose name reflects the date of the inauguration of the Tennessee Valley Authority, which brought public power throughout the South. So there were these vast achievements done by us, done by our government, done by the people together.
And yet people in the South nowadays say that they're afraid of government.
I know, because they've had this, I call it imposed collective amnesia. I mean, in part we've forgotten what we're capable of, and in part we've been brainwashed to believe it's impossible. That's why history is so important, because if it happened before, it can happen again. So if we can just remember what we've accomplished in the past. But you know, there's another leaf to that, to the Roosevelt Republic, because in addition to the New Deal and all of those programs domestically, you know, in order to fight World War II, in order to fight fascism, that Roosevelt had to do all of these economic measures, which were in some ways similar to what Lincoln had to do to fight the Civil War. So Lincoln had to institute an income tax for the first time. Now, it was repealed after the war, and then not reinstated until the early 20th century. But Roosevelt raised the tax rate on the top. He raised the top rate to 95%. He instituted an inheritance tax so that not just income but wealth was taxed. You know, they did all of these economic measures to pay for the war, which, because they were left in place after the war, produced what economists call the Great Compression. So that if you look at a graph of income distribution in the United States from 1945 to 1960 or 65, instead of looking like a pyramid with, you know, a tiny number of people at the top and most of the rest of us at the bottom, like it does now, the 1% and the 99%, it looked like a squashed diamond. It looked like if you'd taken a diamond and pushed it down, so you have a tiny point at the top and a tiny point at the bottom, and then most people were spread out in this vast middle, which was the great American middle class. So it was partly created by government spending, and it was also created by things like the GI Bill, which was, again, paid for by all of these tax rates that were left in place after the war, so that people like my father and my uncle, who would never have been able to afford to go to college, were able to go to college on the GI Bill. So we had, in fact, free college education for a whole cohort after the war, which produced the great American middle class.
I'm speaking with D.D. Guttenplan, whose latest book is The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. You mentioned that you traveled around the country before the 2016 election. Were you surprised when Donald Trump won?
I will be honest with you. I didn't expect him to win, but I wasn't surprised. So I began covering the election in September 2015, and the first thing I did was go to the Republican National Committee summer meeting in Cleveland, which happened a few days before the first debate. Now, your listeners may remember that was the debate where they had two debates because they had so many candidates. They had the grown-ups debate and then the kids' table for people like Lindsey Graham, who were never going to be serious candidates. And what I wrote at the time after that debate was that Donald Trump was the political equivalent of crack cocaine, because he was so willing to defy every norm of civility or political expectation. You know, that was the debate where the moderator said, is there anybody here who won't promise to support the eventual Republican nominee? Please hold up your hand. And Trump held up his hand. And at that point, first of all, it made riveting television. And second of all, I realized that all of the other candidates on the stage were terrified of him. And I figured that he could beat all of them but I also thought at that point that the party would get him off the ticket. I thought that somebody who wouldn't promise to support the eventual nominee would not be allowed to run as a Republican, but I underestimated how desperate for power the Republicans were, or maybe they just were cleverer than me and realized that he was the only candidate who was actually going to be able to beat Hillary Clinton.
You write.
But having said that, I still was surprised on election night. I mean, I spent a lot of 2016 trying to urge people to take the possibility of Trump seriously, because I had covered him as a reporter for the Village Voice and New York Newsday in the 1980s when, you know, of course, New Yorkers remember that he pretended to be a real estate tycoon, but really he was in the casino business because his real estate projects usually ended up going bust.
You write that elitist and democratic strains of republicanism have coexisted uneasily since ancient Athens. In what ways?
In what ways? Well, so Republican, since we're going to go there, okay, let's go there. Republican.
Well, you write about it in your book, so I'm bringing it up.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm glad you're bringing it up. I'm just, you know, it's just a level of erudition that I don't usually get to on a book tour. But, you know, I'm glad you're bringing it up. It's one of the wonderful things about talking with
you. Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. We try harder here.
Good. And dig deeper. So, you know, Plato's Republic, Res Publicus, is what it's called in Latin. Its Greek title is Politeia. And that's what republic comes from. It comes from the Latin translation of a Greek word, politeia, which just means a political entity or the state. But it came to mean the idea of it came to mean in opposition to either a monarchy or an oligarchy. So a republic was a government that was where political power was not transferred through heredity or by force. But it didn't necessarily, they were not always necessarily democratic. You could have a republic which was in some sense ruled by an elite. And so what you have is you've had this tension back and forth between republics which were democratic and republics where somebody managed to seize power, but they weren't able to transmit it hereditarily. So that's been going on for thousands of years. And then, of course, the English Revolution in the 17th century, they called themselves republicans because they were getting rid of the king. They wanted Parliament to rule without the king. But then even after the Restoration, in other words, even after the monarchy was restored in England, there was still a strong political current of republicanism. And it was that current which said that we managed our own affairs better without a king that was incredibly influential on the American founding fathers. I mean, there's a figure in the book that said something like half the private libraries in America had this book that was essentially a work of British Republican propaganda. And so for a while, the opposition was between an absolutist government and republics, or between a monarchy and a republic. But by the time America comes along, the idea of a republic is a government which is where there is some kind of representative democracy rather than power being transmitted hereditarily.
You've also served as the London correspondent for The Nation for many years. They don't call themselves a republic, but it's not a real monarchy, even though it is the United Kingdom. Do they debate these issues?
Well, they do debate it, but it's interesting because what happened, partly because the British had their own revolution and then they had a reaction and the reaction won. So, you know, after the Restoration, the British used republic in two ways. They used republic both to mean a government without a king, what you get if you get rid of a monarchy, and then because they were so attached to republican ideas and because they so wanted to see themselves as the modern version of the Roman Republic and to have all of what were called republican virtues, that in Britain, republic also became a kind of synonym for constitutional monarchy as opposed to absolutist monarchy. So that was all, those debates were very live in the 18th century. And again, they influenced our own founding fathers. But by now, I mean, there are plenty of people in Britain who call themselves republicans, and what they mean is we would like to do away with even the sort of current limited constitutional role of the monarchy. But it's not, I would say most Britons are not republicans. Most Britons are perfectly happy to tug their forelock to the Queen. I don't know how they'll feel when it's Prince Charles. He's a lot less popular than she is. But
if he ever makes it.
You can't say that they have... You can't say they have no role. I mean, if you look at the top news story in the last few days, not just in Britain but in the United States, it's been the birth of somebody who's going to be what, 12th in line, 15th in line to the throne. I mean, if it dominates the news cycle, how can you say it doesn't exist?
Who were the great figures of the two strains, elitist and democratic republicanism in American history? And adding to that, are both Republicans and Democrats tending toward the elitist strain now? For example, we had Mitt Romney speaking about the 47% who pay no income tax, and Hillary Clinton joking about deplorables.
That's right. Well, I would say yes. I would say that both political parties in America for much of certainly the last 15 years have been dominated by the elitist strains of Republicanism, and sometimes worse. I mean, it's hard to know whether Donald Trump is any kind of a Republican, small r or capital R, whereas, you know, Abraham Lincoln was both a small r and a capital R Republican. But I would say that in the 18th century, the two figures who dominated in a sense were Thomas Jefferson, who dominated the sort of Democratic Republicans, which is indeed what the party he founded came to be called, and Alexander Hamilton, who was the elitist strain. And in fact, the first historical chapter of my book is about a little-known episode in American history, the Whiskey Rebellion. And here's an interesting trivia point about the Whiskey Rebellion as an exclusive to Lenny Lopate listeners, which is that in the original public theater production of Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical, there's a song in which Hamilton and Washington plot together to crush this peasant revolt in western Pennsylvania, this taxpayers' revolt of western Pennsylvania farmers who don't want to pay this new tax that Hamilton has instituted as a calculated move basically to crush small producers and bolster big industry, because he felt that America needed a strong mercantile class in order to survive. And so he instituted economic policies designed essentially to shift wealth to the rich. And farmers in western Pennsylvania didn't like that. And they didn't like that not because they didn't like it partly because they had political objections, but also because in the 18th century and the early 19th century, remember, we didn't have canals. The Erie Canal wasn't opened until 1812. There weren't good roads. So if you were someone who was a farmer in western Pennsylvania or eastern Ohio, and you grew grain, the only way to get it to market in Philadelphia or in any of the coastal cities, you know, the big commercial centers, was on horseback over the Allegheny Mountains. And first of all, that took a long time. Secondly, it was expensive to ship grain. You know, you might have, say, 6 mules worth of grain to ship, so you'd have to have a big mule train going over the mountains. And third, you know, if the weather was bad, it might all be rotten by the time it got there. It might be spoiled. So what they tended to do instead was to take the grain and to distill it into whiskey, because the whiskey, first of all, took up a lot less space than the grain needed to make it, and secondly, it kept. You didn't have to worry about it going bad. And third, six mule loads of rye, for example, made enough whiskey to be transported on one mule over the mountain in barrels over the mountains to Philadelphia. But the other thing about it was that you could also use it as a means of exchange among your neighbors. The people used whiskey as a kind of currency in the western areas of the early United States. And Hamilton didn't like any of this. He didn't like the fact that people were using whiskey instead of notes that were issued on banks run by his friends in New York and Philadelphia. He didn't like it the idea that there were these independent, cooperative, or neighbor-based economies in the West, because he felt that they were siphoning economic activity, and he wanted to centralize it in New York, the financial capital. And he didn't like the fact that people who did this tended to not necessarily be so obedient to the dictates of the central government, of the federal government. So he sent 13,000 troops, which was essentially the same size as the entire Continental Army, marching west from Philadelphia to crush this rebellion. And the trivia point for your listeners is that the song in which this is all plotted in the public theater production of Hamilton was dropped before it got to Broadway. So the the Hamilton's villainous role in rigging the system in favor of the rich was emphasized less by the time the play became a big hit.
There were other uprisings as well. Shays' Rebellion in Western Massachusetts. Similar response from Hamilton?
Well, Shays' Rebellion, a similar response from the federal government. Yes, absolutely, Shays' Rebellion was put down. The difference is that Shays' Rebellion happened before the Constitution. Mm. And in part, the Constitution was shaped partly to respond to Shays' Rebellion. And whereas the Whiskey Rebellion happened after the Constitution, and it meant that it was an existential crisis for a lot of people because, you know, people who had fought in the Revolution fought both to throw off the British yoke, but also for their own liberation. And so the question is, what do you do when a government that you've elected, you know, that you consider legitimate, then passes laws which you consider oppressive? How do you respond to them? And what was interesting about the Whiskey Rebellion is that they responded by, they responded by mobilizing the same militias that they had used to fight the British. And in return, Washington and Hamilton mobilized the Continental Army. But they didn't really have a theory about what they were doing. They were doing it kind of like catching a baseball. You know, you and I can catch a baseball. We can't necessarily describe all of the mechanics involved in throwing or catching a baseball, but we still know how to do it. So they were revolting, but they didn't have a kind of political theory to justify what they were doing. In other words, what is the theory that you invoke to justify defying the laws of a legitimately constituted government when they are, in your view, illegitimate or illegal? And the theory didn't come along until Henry David Thoreau with Civil Disobedience. But the fact that the theory did come along and the fact that people then had a way to think about what to do when the government and its laws are unjust, for example, the law that says that if a slave escapes into the North, that the northern governments where they don't have slavery are obliged to cooperate to send him back to slavery. You know, those were exactly the laws that Thoreau is protesting and writing Civil Disobedience in protest and in reaction against. And so there was an evolution from the Whiskey Rebellion, which produced the practice but not the theory, to Thoreau, who produced the theory, to the abolitionists, of which Thoreau was certainly a part, who wedded the theory and practice and eventually forced slavery, largely because of the actions of freed slaves and free black people themselves. They forced slavery onto the political agenda, resulting in the Civil War.
Do questions about President Trump's taxes or growing inequality revive issues that have simmered in the United States since before independence, questions of property?
Yeah, of course, because that's the thing about revolutions. When the Americans made their revolution, or I should say our revolution, when we made our revolution, there were no signposts that said, you've arrived, you can stop now. You know, we knew that being governed by a distant parliament that paid no attention to us was unjust. And we also knew and produced lots of theory to explain that being subject to hereditary rulers was unjust, and that the only just form of government derives from the consent of the governed, as somebody once said. So we knew that, but what we didn't know is what kind of social relations would result when you tore down aristocracy, when you removed a House of Lords in which people were entitled to govern you just because their fathers and grandfathers did, when you removed things like primogeniture, which said that the eldest son got all the property because that was the way of consolidating wealth and preserving it through generations. You know, one of the first things that every state in the Union, every state did after the Revolution was eliminate primogeniture. So all of these questions of property and what's a just amount of property and what are people entitled to and how should income be divided were all up for grabs. And there were states which had much more egalitarian laws. You know, some states had high property qualifications to vote, whereas Vermont had no property qualifications to vote. So, and in the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, they removed all property qualifications for voting. So all of these questions were very much up in the air at the time of the revolution, and they were partly settled one way, but some of them remained, you know, merely suppressed rather than settled, and they rise from, for example, the question of slavery. It took a hundred years for slavery to rise again to the political agenda, but it was there all along. And I think the question of economic inequality and the political results of that has been there from the very beginning and is now surfacing again.
You're listening to Leonard Lopit at Large. Where do you see the rise of a new radical majority, the radical majority of your title, coming from?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because we spent a lot of time talking about history, and there are these three historical chapters in the book, but most of the book is not about history. Most of the book is about people doing work now that I think is both essential and in each case representative of a part of this radical majority. So the first chapter in the book is about a woman called Jane McAlevey, mm-hmm. who's a union organizer, and it's called Winning Under Conditions of Extreme Adversity, because I think we can all agree that we are now in a time of extreme adversity, and yet she's somebody who does the hard work of organizing unions and winning strikes in incredibly difficult conditions. I first met Jane because I was going to Nevada to cover, get a look at the terrain on which the Nevada caucuses were going to be held. And I discovered that she had done an incredible job of organizing healthcare workers' unions. And Nevada, as you'll know, is a right-to-work state. So, you know, this was an uphill fight all the way, and yet she'd been tremendously successful. We met again in Pennsylvania, where she was organizing more nurses' strikes. So that's one part of the majority coalition, of course, is labor. And, you know, the thing that Jane always says is that there's no shortcut to the hard work of organizing. And she differentiates between organizing and mobilizing. So mobilizing is just turning out your people, whether it's to vote or to show up for a rally. And for mobilizing, you're talking to people who already agree with you. And, of course, that's a lot easier than convincing people who don't necessarily agree with you, but who you need to put together enough numbers to wage a successful strike or to win an election.
Haven't unions gotten the short end of the stick from both Republicans and Democrats? And she's critical of what some people call hero organizers and tactics used by people like Barack Obama in the past.
Absolutely. No, I think that's absolutely right. First of all, unions have gotten the short end of the stick since at least the 1930s. But that doesn't mean that they've disappeared or gone away or become any less essential. And so I begin with her because I feel that labor is a key part of any radical majority. I want to give her the chance to make her critique of what she calls hero organizers, which is the kind of Alinsky method where you kind of parachute into a community where you have no particular ties and where you try and recruit people, but you're also manipulating. I mean, her view is that real organizing isn't like that. Real organizing is helping people to assess their own social capital and use it as political capital in a way that allows them, through their numbers and their combined political capital, to defeat the capitalists. And so anyway, that's one part of that coalition, and that's one thing that I see happening. But I also talked to another Jane Klebb, who's a rural organizer, and who organized the opposition to the Keystone Pipeline in Nebraska, putting together a coalition that included ranchers and landowners who you might normally think of and probably often did vote Republican, and you might often think of as pretty conservative people, with Native Americans and environmentalists. So, you know, that chapter is basically how do you put together a coalition of people who are not going to agree on lots of things, but agree on this one essential issue, which is to preserve and save the water resources and the natural resources of the state they live in. And so I show how she did that, and, you know, pretty granular level, so that people can see that it is possible to produce coalitions where we don't all have to hold hands and sing kumbaya. We don't all have to agree with each other about everything. But we can work together to stop the oil corporations from destroying our country. And, you know, so that chapter shows how she did that. Then there's another chapter where I focus on a young man, Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who is the first openly gay Latino elected official in the state of Illinois. He's a Chicago alderman.
He calls himself a democratic socialist.
He is a democratic socialist. He also calls himself a movement politician. And that, to me, is at least as interesting. I mean, it's nice that he calls himself a democratic socialist and he gets elected and he belongs to DSA, and I think those are all great things. But I think what's important about Carlos is two other things as well, which is that, one, his focus on immigrant rights and immigrant organizing in the big city context. And the second, in some ways even more radical but also more encouraging, is the way that he views his role as someone who both is responsible to and is the kind of representative of the movement that brought him to power, that allowed him to get elected. Because when he ran for alderman, he was somebody who was in his 20s and he owned two suits. You know, he had saved 3 months' salary and that was it. So he took 3 months off to try and run for this job that if he didn't get, he was going to have to go back to work so he could pay his rent. You know, he wasn't someone who had corporate backing, and he's not someone who takes PAC contributions. And yet he won, and then his ward in Chicago delivered the biggest margin for Bernie Sanders in the state of Illinois. So part of what Carlos is about is showing that you can have a different kind of big city politics as well.
In an interview about a year ago, Steve Bannon said, if the left is focused on race and identity and we, the Republicans, go with economic nationalism, we can crush the Democrats. And okay, so Carlos Ramirez Rosa won. Go ahead.
Like everything that Bannon says, that has both a deep truth and a deep lie. You know, I mean, Bannon is a disciple of Breitbart, and Breitbart's great insight was that politics is downstream of culture. That if you really want to change the politics, you have to change the culture too. And so that's why Bannon is always waging cultural war. So even though he says in that, and that's the deep lie in that quote, is he pretends that if Democrats concentrate on culture and we concentrate on the economy, we win. But if you look at what he's been doing, he has been concentrating on culture, not the economy. So part of that is just a feint. And the other part is that, yes, if we don't offer people a better economic, if we don't raise the bar, if we don't have a better economic offer, then we are going to lose. And I think, you know, that's something that we have to think about now. If you were listening to the radio a week ago, you would have heard both the kind of culture war going on over the Kavanaugh confirmation, and you would have heard the news that unemployment is at its lowest level since 1969. So, you know, the Democratic response has to deal with both of those phenomena. We have to find a way, and it's not easy. You know, that's one of the reasons why Jane McAlevey, whose mantra is no shortcuts, is the subject of my first chapter.
You also discuss Zephyr Teachout in this book, the former New York gubernatorial.
I do. We'll come to that. But I want to say that you have to both address culture and economics. You can't just do one or the other. You know, there are plenty of people that look like you and me who will always tell you on the left that if we would just stop banging on about race or about gender, we could put together a class-based politics. And in a sense, that's what Bannon is doing. He's the siren song for the kind of white male leftist. But I think he's full of crap. And I think that you can't put together an economic argument. You have to deal with people's actual lives. And people's actual lives are a lot more complex than just being economic actors. Now, about Zephyr Teachout, she's the last chapter in the book, and she's really important. First of all, because I think she's a wonderfully gifted politician.
But she hasn't won election, and she even got the endorsement of the New York Times, but didn't get the attorney general, didn't win attorney general. Is she one of the, she criticized the Democratic Party organization for not really being representative of the people. Does that explain to some degree why she hasn't gotten the support of the party?
Well, I think she hasn't gotten the support of the party because the Democratic Party in New York State is a puppet in the hands of Andrew Cuomo. We both know that. So the obviously she's not going to get the support of the party while the party exists as Cuomo's personal vehicle, and she was the person who bloodied his nose running for governor 8 years, 4 years ago. I don't think that's difficult to understand, and I'm sure your listeners understand that. I mean, it was impressive that she got the New York Times endorsement, although, of course, she was endorsed earlier by The Nation magazine. But I'm glad that the Times followed our lead. And I think what's really important about Zephyr is not so much whether she wins office now or later, because I have no doubt that eventually she will be elected to some office if she's willing to keep running. It's her critique of corruption. You know, she wrote the book on corruption. It's called A History of Corruption in America, Corruption and Political History. And the thing is that too often in the left, and particularly, I would say, in urban politics, we don't pay any attention to corruption. We pay attention to whether we're electing the right kind of people, people who say the right things or who look the right way. And then we turn our backs as they become corrupted by the power we've elected them to and become part of a corrupt political machine that suppresses dissent, and not just suppresses dissent, but, you know, does all the things that Andrew Cuomo has done as governor. It eliminates corruption commissions and all those kinds of things. And yet, if you do that, then people become disillusioned and they feel that there's no point in voting, because even if we get our people in, they'll just go on the corporate tit the way everybody else is going on the corporate tit.
Won't many people vote for him simply because they see him as the lesser of the two evils, which is often the case when we vote in this country?
No, well, that's right. And as long as you offer the people the choice of the lesser of two evils, you can guarantee two things. One, that all you're going to get is a lesser evil. And two, that more and more people are going to get fed up with being constantly offered the choice of the lesser of two evils. So I think, but there's a sort of larger thing as well about corruption, which is it's not just that politicians become corrupt. It's that corruption in politics is the expression and the fruit of overwhelming corporate domination of our politics. And it's Zephyr Teachout's critique of overweening corporate power that I feel makes her an essential part of any majority coalition. And I think if you look, you know, this all sounds very abstract, but one of the things that she does is she talks about chickenization and the way in which chicken farmers all across the country have essentially become serfs to the big poultry producers, to Tyson and Pilgrim. But it's not just chicken farmers. It happens in lots of other spheres. I remember when I was following Zephyr around when she was campaigning, she introduced me to a man named Abe Saperstein from a small town in upstate New York who runs a dry goods store. His family's run a dry goods store for years. And, you know, like a lot of country dry goods stores, they sell Oshkosh jeans. But Oshkosh started refusing to stock his store unless he would order, like, 50,000 jeans, you know, and this is in a town with a population of a few hundred. And why would they do that? Because they can. Because, you know, he doesn't have any place else to go, and because they're not really interested in keeping small businesses or small towns alive. And so her point is that we have to find a way to break up, to oppose and break up this kind of corporate conglomeratization. So that, you know, otherwise we're going to end up in a world where only Amazon gets to decide what books you can read or what books you can publish.
Now, Zephyr Teachout says that once in every generation we're called upon to restore American democracy. A generation is about 25 to 30 years. Shouldn't older Americans be able to remember one or two previous rounds of restoration? Are we failing to learn the lessons from the past?
Well, I think people who give up have failed to learn lessons from the past. But I think, of course, Americans my age can remember, you know, we can remember the civil rights movement. We can remember enormous change. We can remember feminism. We can remember the Stonewall riot. You know, we can remember that people rose up, you know, within our lifetimes and brought about incredible political changes. So, you know, if you said to somebody, even as recently as, I don't know, 1990, that gay marriage would be legal in the United States in 20 years, you know, they'd have thought you were insane.
Although it may be made illegal again, that they're is always a possibility.
Well, I think, yeah, I think this. Well, I think given the current constellation of the court, the stakes are very high. But I suppose, you know, and I think I would certainly support anybody who is mobilizing to protect it. But I also think that one of the things that the fight for gay marriage shows is that when the left learns the Breitbart lesson, you know, the law changed, but the law changed because the culture changed. And we did that. Maybe not you, but everybody who ever went on a gay rights march or a gay pride march or, or came out in support of their friends and relatives who were coming out, we changed that. And I think the court could decide to change the law, but I doubt they will because we've already changed the culture. If we can do it on gay rights, we can also do it on income inequality, on corporate domination, on the role of fossil fuels in our economy and in our ecology. We can make those big changes.
We just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to bring up the fact that you wrote a biography of I.F. Stone under the title American Radical. He was a very influential thinker during his lifetime. Does much of his legacy remain today?
Well, does his legacy remain among people who say his name and know him as, you know, as their predecessor? I don't know. I don't have any way to assess that. You know,
ideas still alive? For example,
I think his ideas.
Go ahead.
I think go ahead.
No, I was just curious because it seems to me that every generation we also have somebody who stirs people up and we have somebody like LBJ who does a lot of things to change the plight, race issues and the plight of the poor, and then there's a retrenchment that follows.
Well, I think, you know, history, Mark Twain said history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, so... One of the things that interests me is if you go to the two counties in western Pennsylvania that were the center of the Whiskey Rebellion in the 18th century, and you look at the 2016 election returns, those two counties, which were Democratic before 2016, provided 80,000 votes for Donald Trump in a state that he beat Hillary Clinton by 68,000 votes. So, you know, yes, history sometimes tends to rhyme, but I would say about Stone that there are two things that I would say are a huge part of his legacy. One is that we now know that all governments lie, which was his great aphorism. And he also said all governments lie, but the ones who believe the stuff they put out, who believe their own lies, are the ones that are the most dangerous. So, you know, it's important to bear in mind the second part of that. And the other is that the idea that if you want to have a truly independent press, you have to be willing to pay for it. You know, that a press that's dependent on advertising will never be truly independent of the corporations that advertise. And I think more and more people have responded to that. I think that's the sort of the whole enormous growth of, you know, alternative media is essentially those are all I.F. Stone's grandchildren, whether they know it or not.
We don't have any more time, so we couldn't get into talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Stacey Abrams, and David Garcia. But maybe we'll have you back sometime soon. I hope we can do that.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And Dede Guttenplan's latest book is The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority, published by Seven Stories Press. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Dede Guttenplan, to Hugh Sansom, who produced the show, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.